Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump tweeting out, "Denuclearization will be a great thing for the world, but also for North Korea," after announcing that his head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, who is awaiting Senate confirmation as the next Secretary of State, secretly visited North Korea and met with Kim Jong-un to lay the groundwork for a summit meeting between Trump and Kim. A former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, joins us to discuss how it is likely the summit will take place, but exactly what denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means remains as unclear as it will be difficult to achieve. We'll look into whether a peace treaty to end the Korean War will be on the table. And since Donald Gregg is close to former President George H.W. Bush and knew Barbara Bush well, we will get his impressions and memories of the former First Lady, who passed away yesterday and today is being remembered as tributes pour in. Then, with Cuba's Communist Party poised to announce a successor to Raul Castro tomorrow, we will assess the new leader, 57-year-old Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, who is the first outside of the Castro dynasty, which has ruled the country since the revolution over 50 years ago. Mark Frank, a freelance journalist based in Cuba who writes for Reuters and the Financial Times and is the author of Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana, joins us to discuss how the internet-savvy Díaz-Canel can go about modernizing Cuba's moribund economy and getting the country more connected to the world, as the U.S. under Trump turns back the clock to impose more isolation on the island nation. Then finally, we will speak with Anne Louise Bardak, the author of Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana, and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. She joins us to discuss how the expectations of young Cubans can be met in terms of both wanting the social services the government provides, but also wanting to be free of a government that won't give them access to the outside world or let them travel and has them under constant surveillance. And joining us now is Donald Gregg, a career CIA officer who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Gregg.
Delighted to be with you.
And Ambassador, what do you make of the secret trip that took place over Easter with the outgoing head of the CIA meeting apparently with Kim Jong-un in North Korea? The president made an announcement yesterday in a photo opportunity with the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. The president said it happened last week, but apparently it happened earlier than that. But it was conducted in secret, and it seems a little odd for somebody that's a lame duck at the CIA and not yet our chief diplomat, our Secretary of State, to be on this mission. What's your impression?
Well, I first have to say my hat's off to them for being able to have somebody go in secret to Pyongyang without it leaking. That's hard to do. And maybe it was easier to do because they chose a rather unlikely person to send. I am not overly impressed by anything that this administration has done in terms of diplomacy, and these recent maneuvers seem to be rather bizarre to me, given the fact that we don't have a formal ambassador to North Korea or to South Korea, and that so many of our diplomatic posts are vacant.
Well, it seems, though, that it's quite likely that Mike Pompeo will not get the confirmation via the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The full Senate may well approve his nomination. So not getting the vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is, I think, unprecedented and a little embarrassing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, has that been formally announced today?
No, it hasn't been announced, but that's the head count at this point.
What is the head count at this point?
Well, you've got, apparently, on the Republican side, Rand Paul opposes him, and then pretty much all the Democrats. So I believe that it's pretty close, if not going to go against him.
Well, I'm not really surprised at that. I mean, I think, as I say, I've just not been very much impressed by anything that this administration has done in terms of diplomacy. And I think they the worse it gets, the less likely they are to have really talented people flock to them saying, oh, yes, I certainly want to work for this president, and I want to be able to tell my grandchildren that this is what I did. That's not going to happen. And I think it's highly unfortunate, and I think that we have a difficult 3 years ahead of us.
Well, on the other hand, maybe because he's so unorthodox, the current president, that he might be able to pull this deal off. That's what a lot of people are saying. But at the same time, we don't know what kind of a deal it is. And if it's about denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, which is what we've been told is sort of what's in the works there, that's pretty complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And so I have, having said what I just said, I sort of undercut myself by saying we should not demonize Mr. Trump. A stopped clock is right twice a day, and in this case, he may actually accomplish something, and if so, more credit to him. But certainly the denuclearization is something that I think we can do. The North Koreans are not suicidal. They know that if they launch anything really high-tech toward us, we are likely to virtually obliterate their country. They're not going to do that. So that we have, in my view, a soluble problem to address here. It's much, much easier than anything we are trying to do in the long-running conflicts in the Middle East. So I'm no fan of these people, but I would be very glad to see them accomplish something in working toward the denuclearization issue, because I think that can be accomplished.
So just in terms of the complication, though, of denuclearizing the whole peninsula, it's highly unlikely, I would think, given the enormous investments that Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans have made in their nuclear program, to give it up entirely. But if that's a possibility, then, you know, hats off to Pompeo and Trump. But on the other hand, wouldn't it also imply the South Koreans giving up the nuclear umbrella that the United States provides?
Well, it would depend upon if that was a demand put out by the North Koreans that they do that, then I think we would have a less benign attitude toward the negotiation. Now, I think that there are certainly ways that North Korea has developed nuclear weapons to keep us from blowing them out of the water. They are very frank about that. And they are saying if we become convinced that you don't intend to do that, we will be willing to talk about denuclearization. But some of the nuclear developments can be diverted from away from weapons into power generation or other areas, so that all of the money that has been spent is not necessarily wasted. I think what needs to happen is that the Trump administration sort of shows enough of itself and some consistency and some intelligence to begin to win some degree of confidence from our foreign friends and our foreign would-be friends. There hasn't been much of that going on. I think Pompeo is not a particularly attractive figure in that way, but I think it's going to be hard to get really stalwart people to sign on for working for Trump, at least now, until he has not accomplished much in this area.
Well, how do you think the South Koreans feel about it? Now, we can talk about how Abe feels. He didn't look entirely comfortable at the photo opportunity in Mar-a-Lago yesterday.
He looked as though he was looking forward to teeing off,
but,
and not much else.
But to begin with, it was the South Korean National Intelligence Service head, Soo Hoon, who went to North Korea at the time of the Winter Olympics and then showed up at the White House. Apparently, he was in the executive office building when he was summoned into the Oval Office, and suddenly He told Trump that the North Koreans were interested in having a summit, and Trump immediately agreed, which apparently stunned the South Koreans. Is that your understanding of how this deal got in motion?
Yes, it is. It's very bizarre. And I don't know who greased the skids to get him into the Oval Office in the first place. And I don't know what led up to that. So that, the people who are involved are more adroit than I have given them credit for. But it's a very strange series of events that have taken place.
And what about this idea that's now being floated that on the agenda is not just a nuclear deal, which is in itself a pretty high bar, but a formal ending of the Korean War, which, of course, operates still under an armistice, and thus the theatrics that go on daily at Panmunjom?
Well, I mean, I think that is something that is tremendously overdue. I think people are surprised to hear that there's just an armistice agreement. You know, people forget about things. They've lasted for so long. So there is something that certainly could be done better. And I think, anything that gets us away from just a truce agreement to something permanent is very much in interest of the whole region. And so more power to them if they can do it. But the characters they have lined up to become involved are, to me, rather strange and not terribly confidence-inspiring.
On which, our side or on both sides?
Both sides. But more on ours than on the South Koreans or the North Koreans. I think I've been impressed by the North Koreans. I think Kim Jong-un is a very talented, risk-taking young man who's going to be around for a long, long time. And I think if we can gradually establish some sort of relationship of some confidence with him, that will do us and do the Koreans a lot of good, because we're going to be dealing him with for the next 20 years at least.
Well, but isn't there, obviously, there's a tremendous difference between North and South Korea economically, politically, and even militarily, even though North Korea is a kind of garrison state. How does a deal take place that wouldn't, at the end of the day, bring about more contact between the North and the South? And the understanding I've always had is that the North is very afraid of its people learning about the high standard of living in the South. Apparently, pirated copies of South Korean soap operas end up in the North, and the authorities arrest people and send them to the gulag if they're caught. The electricity turns off and the cassette gets jammed in the player, and the people are arrested. So that would indicate to me that they're afraid of bursting the kind of propaganda bubble that North Koreans endure from cradle to grave.
Well, that's a very interesting point you raise, because I've been to North Korea 6 times and in over a 12-year gap. And the first time I went was in 2002, and it was a pretty sad place, Pyongyang was. The roads were lousy. There were just rusty old trucks rustling around. The food was poor. The hotel I stayed in had been built by the Japanese and had somehow not been bombed. It was a pretty decrepit place. And in the 6 times I have been there, the last time being in 2014, it's changed completely. And the last time I was there, the Pyongyang has become quite an attractive city with a lot of new and seemingly well-constructed buildings. There are new cars on the road. The people are dressed better. The food is delicious. And I feel very comfortable going there. So as that has happened, the North Koreans have become more confident about themselves and their own future. And I think that's a very good thing to have happened, and I think it will make it easier for them to deal with, assuming that the South Koreans are deal with them with care and don't look down at them in a kind of condescending fashion.
But the United Nations has written some very damning reports about North Korea's human rights situation and the amount of political prisoners in their gulags. Will that change? Will that moderate?
I think it absolutely will change. I think that as we have seen other sort of troglodyte states change, they have changed as they are aware that they need to change if they're going to become a full-fledged member of the family of nations. And I think that's beginning to start with North Korea as of now. And I base that upon the conversations I've had with the North Koreans and the observations I have seen going in and out of their country for six times over a 12-year period.
And in terms of those that might be brokering this deal, or at least having some tangential arrangement in this deal, often, of course, we turn to China as though China can get our irons out of the fire. And there's also talk of Russia helping out. On both counts, China is now being threatened with a trade war, and Russia, of course, things are very tense, although the latest round of sanctions was reversed by President Trump, which is certainly raises lots of questions about what kind of relationship Trump has with Putin or what kind of hold Putin has over Trump. But my sense is that the Russians probably don't have much to do with this, nor did the Chinese. This is actually something that's going to be totally bilateral between the U.S. and North Korea. Is that your understanding?
I would agree with that. And I think it's healthy that people like you and me are beginning to think that way. Because I think that deals made by two countries because they see it's in their advantage to make a deal are much more likely to be lasting than something sort of put over their heads by foreign intervention or foreign support or foreign beleaguerment that they sort of go along with because they can't find a way to oppose it. So I think this is rather healthy, what's happening, what you just described.
Well, but on the other hand, I think some foreign policy experts are pretty skeptical. Donald Trump seems to be more interested in the cosmetics and looking good. He spends an awful lot of time looking at himself on television, you know, sometimes up to 8 hours a day. And so if you've got two sort of narcissists making a deal, it may be more cosmetic than substantive.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, and I find it very difficult to talk about this because I don't like Trump. I don't admire him. I wish he weren't our president. But it still is quite possible that something good may come out of his administration if he plays along with some forces that are now working more naturally between North and South Korea.
Well, obviously the victory here would be, and we've got to this point because the North Koreans have reached a point, apparently, not necessarily they've tested their nuclear tipped missiles, but they've certainly tested nuclear weapons and they've tested missiles. And the assumption is that they have the ability to now strike American cities. So to get rid of that threat is a very important, obviously. But on the other hand, it would indicate that that may well be what the North Koreans are up to. In other words, you get to the point where you threaten the U.S. and then so the question would be, what are the sweeteners? If you look, for example, at the deal with Iran under Obama, the Iranians, the mere threat that they would go nuclear brought about the end of sanctions. So in this case, it would seem that the North Koreans hold more cards.
Well, that's complicated because I think that the Iran agreement is one of the best we've struck. It's very tenuous, very difficult, very unpopular, but I think it does a hell of a lot of good. So I think with the North Koreans, we're dealing with less sophisticated people, and I think they are, you know, I'm not sure yet what to make of them, how skilled they're going to be in sort of making themselves more acceptable to their neighbors and to the family of nations in that part of the world. They're making some moves in that direction. I think we ought to encourage that, but I'm not sure how far it's going to get.
What do you think there are sweeteners involved?
Inducements. Sweeteners.
Inducements on our part or on the part of the South Koreans? Or
even— yeah, I think so. I mean, well, I think the biggest inducement is to make the North Koreans feel more secure in that we're not going to blow them out of the water. I mean, I've talked to the North Koreans, and they say every time we fly nuclear-capable bomber anywhere in their area, they just, you know, it just scares the hell out of them. I mean, they remember that MacArthur wanted to drop a necklace of nuclear weapons around across North Korean Peninsula. It's taken them a long time to get over that, and I don't think they're really over it yet, because I think we are regarded by them as an existential threat, and it's going to it's going to take them a while and some skilled diplomacy on our part to sort of deal with us in a more normal fashion.
And, of course, you mentioned earlier when you first went there, you stayed in a Japanese hotel. That would have been built during the colonial period of Japanese occupation, and that probably would have been one of the few buildings that survived the U.S. bombing of North Korea during the Korean War.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, Ambassador Gregg, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your
time. Well, not at all. I'm not sure how coherent I've been on this, but it's very murky.
Right. Well, I agree, and I'm conflicted because on the one hand, I wish Donald Trump were not our president, as you do. I wish he would go away, but this deal may actually help him stay in the Oval Office.
Right. Well, you and I are exactly on the same wavelength on that, so thank you for saying so.
Well, just in closing, I was going to ask you about the First Lady, Barbara Bush, just passed. There's a great deal of attention now being paid to her legacy. Did you ever know her at all?
Oh, I knew her very well. I was her husband's national security advisor for 6.5 years. I went to 65 countries with the Bushes. And I knew Barbara very well. She was a wonderful woman with a great sense of humor. And, I mean, she... we were in London and at a big garden party given by our ambassador there, and there were some very high society people there, and Mrs. Bush sort of became offended by one woman who was swanning around in a very sort of extreme dress, and she called me over and said, "Don, Madame Bovary," we'll call her Madame Bovary, that's not who she was, but I'm not going to say who she was. She said, "Madame Bovary has forgotten to put on her brassiere, and I want you to go over and tell her that." I said, "Mrs. Bush, I would charge a machine gun nest in your defense, but I haven't the courage to go over and tell Madame Bovary that she has forgotten to put on her brassiere." And Mrs. Bush said, "Well, I am deeply, deeply disappointed in you." And that's sort of one of my favorite stories about her. But she was capable of doing that kind of thing, a great sense of humor.
So when you hear that the Bush family, the granddaughter said this, Jenna, that she was known within the family as the enforcer, did she play a bigger role behind the scenes in her husband's presidency?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she was a solid, solid person. And you really had to know what you were talking about to talk with her. And if she thought that you were leading in a direction that might do some damage to her, you know, to her husband, she was like a tigress. So she was a force to be reckoned with. And delightful if you were able to sort of get through to her, as I eventually did. Some people didn't. And she could make life miserable for you if she felt that you were not doing a good job in terms of furthering our objectives diplomatically.
Well, there were reports, though, that she didn't get on well with Nancy Reagan. Was that your impression?
I think so. I think they were very, very different people. I mean, Nancy was difficult to talk to, and they were very, very different women. And for them to have gotten along, very easily and in a friendly fashion would have been, I think, unexpected given where they came from, who they were, what their backgrounds were, the clothes they wore, the things that were important to them.
Well, Ambassador Gregg, I thank you for your insight in having known the First Lady who just passed.
Well, and I think, you know, I think, I hate to say this, but I don't think her husband is going to last much longer without her. I mean, she was just a tremendous support to him. He's in very poor shape as it is, and I think we'll be saying goodbye to him before too long. And I think he was a very effective representative of this country, and I hope he is given the respect that he deserves.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Donald Gregg, a career CIA officer who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back assessing the new leader of Cuba, the 57-year-old Miguel Diaz-Canel Bermudez.